The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hello and welcome to the second edition of Red Leg Roundtable. I am thrilled to welcome in my second guest, Scott Hattieburg, former Red. Scott, thanks for joining me.
Hey, good to see you, Seth. Good to be here.
Awesome, awesome. Hey, so I wanted you to kind of start us off by telling me a little bit about your time with the Reds, just in general, and then I want to go backwards and tell your story, your baseball story. So what, I guess, those, especially 06 and 07, what are your memories of being with the Reds?
Well, I mean, first off, I mean, I'm an old guy at this point. You know, I'd spent my entire career in the American League. So It was my first, foray into the National League. And I was thrilled. Wayne Krivsky was the GM at the time, and he was excited to get me over. And I was just excited to have people excited to have me over. And this was a really fun team, especially from an offensive standpoint. Ken Griffey, I'm a Northwest guy. I mean, this guy was a hero of mine forever, and getting to play with him was just a huge thrill. Adam Dunn, we became buddies to this day. So there was a lot of offense there, and it was fun to be a part of. And it was a newer ballpark, or might have been semi-brand new. And
loved
playing there. Absolutely loved the area, loved playing there. I think we got off to some really good starts and kind of fizzled a little bit. Didn't quite have the pitching depth that, we needed, but, other than that, it was a really great time, and I got nothing but great memories.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, we'll go a little more, fine tooth comb through, especially 2006. That was a pivotal year for the franchise. That was Wayne Krivsky's first year as GM. So, but I want to tell your story a little bit. You were born on December 14th, 1969 in Salem, Oregon. And you went to Dwight D. Eisenhower High School is it Yakima, Washington?
Yeah, Washington.
I got it right. Okay. You were drafted out of high school in the 12th round by the Phillies, but you decided to go to college at Washington State. Talk a little bit about that decision.
It was a decision. I wanted to go to Washington State. At the time, it was a really good program. I mean, they were, a lot of guys from Yakima had gone there. It was kind of a baseball town. So it was a dream to go play there. Obviously, the pro game was a dream as well. I just felt like I was skipping a step. I was kind of an undersized kid. I felt like really my thought process was if I didn't make it in college and improve my draft status, I wouldn't have done squat in the minor leagues. Right. And so I really kind of just followed that and ended up going to Washington State and did get better. I got more physical and I got the experience of I got to play for Team USA. I played on some really good Washington State teams. I was teammates with Aaron Seeley and John Olerud, some great major leaguers. So, and then play under the tutelage of Bobo Brayton, who was one of the winningest coaches in all of college baseball. And all those elements, I think, combined to really prepare me for the setting of the pro game, which I think it was a great decision.
Sure. I mean, it worked out great for you. And you mentioned, being a battery mate with Aaron Seeley. If you're at a college and you end up with two longtime Major League Baseball players playing together, that's really impressive. What was it like kind of growing up in the Pacific Northwest as a baseball player? Here in Ohio, certainly you've got the cold weather, but you've got that tradition down in Cincinnati with so many big leaguers having gone to Moeller and things like that. But for the most part, obviously, if you grew up in California or Florida or places like that, it's a little easier.
Yeah, you got to learn how to hit a wet baseball, right? I mean, and you know, you get that vibration in the hands, you know. So
sure.
I don't know, maybe it makes you a little tougher. I don't know. The one mistake people have about Washington is it rains all the time. It's just really on the west side. Yakima is kind of on the, is really desert. It's on the other side, central Washington, so it's on the other side of the mountains. Stays much drier, does get cold, but unlike the west side, doesn't get quite the rain. So you didn't get the rain outs like you would on the west side. So I did get to get out and play, not like California or anything. I wasn't in short sleeves and stuff, more Gore-Tex and puffy coats and stuff. But I did play. I think that there was just a, it was very, it's kind of a baseball-y state and especially city where I grew up in. So maybe not the perfect environment to play, but it was in the air.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, you later on in 2015, you were inducted to Washington State's Hall of Fame. What an honor that must have been.
Oh, humongous. I mean, getting into that was just beyond a thrill. There's such great players that have gone through there. And my kids went there. My wife went there. We're just diehard Washington State guys, family. And then to just get put into the Hall of Fame, man, that's just a huge cherry on the top.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I really cherish it. Very excited about that.
I actually knew your current athletic director, Pat Chun. I knew him. He started Ohio State. He was in media relations. So when I was in student radio calling baseball games, he was the kind of the PR arm of the university at that point. So I got to know him a little bit years ago. And he was rumored to possibly be Ohio State's next AD, but he's going to stay out there on the Palouse. So that's, I guess, good for you guys.
That's good. I keep hearing his name thrown around, so I'm glad he's sticking around.
You get a little worried, maybe. Talk a little bit about being drafted then again in 1991. You went in the first round this time, so the choice, I guess, paid off, right?
Yeah, it did. I mean, what I thought would need to happen, you know, ended up happening. You know, I got a little better, bigger. I mean, got to play the competition, and I just needed to mature some. I had great coaching. We had great teams, and you know, for me, physically, it just. Baseball's a weird game. I mean, it takes a long time to figure out. You know, basketball and football, you get drafted and you go in and make an impact. Baseball, you got to go to the freaking Beloit and, you know, and try to – it just takes a long time to figure this game out. And it took me a little longer as far as the maturing part. And, it just – things started to click and had some good years at Wazoo and ended up getting to be a first-rounder. Actually was drafted by the Red Sox, who Aaron Seeley – was their first pick, and I was their second pick. So ended up continuing on with the Red Sox, which was totally cool.
That is neat. They must have had a good scout up there in the Northwest at that time.
I don't even know if we met him either. So that was pretty cool.
Well, I guess, you know, you spent some time, certainly you made your debut in 95, and you spent some time all the way up through 01 with Boston and the organization. And obviously you mentioned the minor leagues. Tell me a little bit about Fenway Park or some of the memories of being a Red Sox player in those years.
Well, Fenway Park, I mean, just the history and then the actual facility is, I mean, I get chills to this day going into that place. It's just, I don't know, it's so rich in all of that. And plus the tradition of, you know, doing as well as they have always done. I mean, the people that, Ted Williams would be around, Yastrzemski would be around. I mean, Jim Rice was my hitting coach. And I grew up as just a baseball geek, you know, baseball cards and all of a sudden. So how could you not love the Red Sox? And I knew everything about them. In fact, I was interesting side note. You said my birthday and it's December 14th and, you know, I collected baseball cards and Bill Buckner's birthday is December 14th.
Okay.
And, cause I just knew I was, you know, you'd look at baseball cards, you consume everything. And, I remember him and it's a ruthless town, Boston. And
yes.
I never told anybody cause Buckner had a tough reputation in Boston. And one year we were playing the Yankees in the playoffs and I was pinch hitting hitting at the end of the game and I ended up striking out and our season was over and somebody had held that in their freaking, in their cards and they played it at one of the newspaper guys and he said, "We'll never break this curse unless we trade Scott Hatterberg. He was born on the same day as Bill Buckner." And I thought, oh gosh, it's the cat's out of the bag. But
yeah, no, somebody did their research.
Well, somebody held on to that.
Well, and certainly, I mean, so you made your debut September 8th, 1995. Every big leaguer probably will forever remember their debut. What was it like when you got the call? What was it like to go ahead and make your first, get in the game for the first time as a Red Sox?
Well, it was at the end of the season, you know, and we're in a pennant race with the Yankees, and, you know, the Yankees were Jeter and all those you know, the famous Yankee teams. And we were really good too. You know, Mo Vaughn, Pedro Martinez. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were stacked too. They just seemed to have our number, and they were better than we are. But I got called up, and I remember my first game was in the Bronx. You know, late September. I mean, this is the pressure cooker, man. Yankees, Red Sox battling for the pennant. And I've never felt an environment like that. And I remember I got a pinch hit one night against David Cone, my first at bat in the big leagues. And just a little backstory, Don Mattingly was like, I was in love with this guy, Don Mattingly. And he's mm-hmm. first baseman at the time for the Yankees. And I got my first at bat, and I'm facing David Cone. He was so good. And I end up, I don't know how, I could barely feel my body. And I ended up taking a ball right down the line, almost goes out of the ballpark, but almost foul. But line drive right down the line, hits the wall, easy double. Mm-hmm. I come around first base, trucking, floating on air. And as I'm passing first base, Don Mattingly goes in front of my view. And I'm like, what are you doing, dude? You're going to pass up a chance to sit and talk to Don Mattingly at first base? So I put the brakes on and first base. I gave up the double. I couldn't care less. I didn't know if I was ever going to get back here. And he came up and he said, hey, rookie, they show you where second base was? Anyway, he teased me, and it was a great moment, but that was my first at bat, and I'll never forget it, like you said.
That's awesome. That is a great story. I think it was the fall of 98. I went up to Cleveland. I was at Ohio State at the time, and Boston played in Cleveland, I believe, in the playoffs. I believe it was 98. So I intersected a little bit with you. But you had those seasons there, and then – you know, a little nugget for Reds fans, you know, especially talking to Eddie Tobinski last week, we were really reminiscing about the 1999 Reds season when they won 96 games. You were actually traded to the Rockies in December of 01 for Pokey Reese. So that's a little tie with the Reds there too. And of course, I assume they let you go, you know, over that winter, because now the now famous by the book and the movie Moneyball, that's when the transition you made from catcher to first base. I'm sure you get asked about Moneyball all the time, and so I'm not going to be the one that doesn't ask you. I have to ask you a little bit about it. Was the plan originally for you to play yourself, as it's been talked about? Were you going to be in the movie?
Oh, shoot, yeah. In fact, my wife was going to be in the movie. The only player was going to be Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt was going to play Billy the whole time.
Right.
I think Brad Pitt owned the rights to the movie, and this is kind of Steve Soderbergh was the original director, but we were all down in California getting haircuts and costumed and getting ready to roll this thing.
Yeah.
And Steve Soderbergh was so cool, man. Gosh, this guy, he had a vision for it. It scared the crap out of me. I was like, what do we know about acting? I know my wife doesn't know anything about acting. I don't know how we're going to pull this off. And it was like hours before we were start shooting that version of it, and Sony, who I think was the backing of the money, and they pulled the plug, and I thought, oh gosh, you know, we dodged a bullet there. But they, you know, Brad Pitt, I think, like I said, still owned the rights, still may wanted to get it made, and ended up becoming what it became. But originally we were going to play ourselves. So
wow. Thank God. Well, interspersed, I watched it again this weekend with my 13-year-old son to kind of remind myself a little bit about it. And they interspersed video of, you know, you and, on the field versus Chris Pratt during the, you know, when he was, you know, had dialogue and things like that. There's other things too I need to ask you about. How accurate is the depiction of Billy Beane and Ron Washington visiting you up in the Northwest to talk to you about coming to the A's?
Yeah, no, they didn't come to the house. That's a little hot Hollywood hot sauce right there.
Uh-huh.
They did call me on Christmas Eve. I remember talking to Billy. It felt like he was in my living room, but he was adamant. Like you said, I had got traded to the Rockies, and there's a little period in the window of signing. Like I had an option. I didn't sign with the Rockies, so I never really became a Rocky. Though my rights were traded to him, but there's a little window. You either sign or become a free agent.
Okay.
I opted to become a free agent, and then Billy had jumped on me as far as, you know, he wanted to sign me really quick to go replace Jason Giambi at first base. I thought this guy was crazy.
That's right.
I'm a catcher. I caught my whole life. I did not pick up a ground ball ever other than just out of fun. So I thought he was crazy, but he was offering a lot of at bats, and I jumped at it.
Well, and I've got my contractor here. He's replacing a bathroom. We had a leaky shower. And I was mentioning I was going to talk to you yesterday, and he said, it's not that hard. So he's quoting the movie right away. So that's the next question. You know, and certainly since they didn't visit you together, and I always thought it was kind of weird that Ron Washington, who's a coach, like an on-the-field coach,
right,
would make a trip with the general manager. I didn't really think that would be that realistic, but did Billy try to convince you it would be easy versus somebody else telling you, no, it's hard?
He never told me either way. I remember, though, I was in spring training, and I was obviously a catcher. Everybody knew me as a catcher. Mm-hmm. He said, just carry your catching bag around, take a bunch of ground balls. It'll look like, you know, you may be playing a couple positions, but we're not going to catch you, you know? So I carried this catcher's bag around, never put it on the whole time, but it was just kind of a ruse to keep the, you know, the newspapers off the scent of how crazy Billy must've looked about replacing Giambi with me. But I spent a ton of time with Ron Washington, and thank God, I don't know if it worked with anybody else. Ron Washington is such a savant. He's such maybe the best coach, you know, it's just as far as technique and teaching infield that I've ever come across. And
yeah, he's got a reputation.
Oh, he's just, it's something special. And so he molded me, and, you know, I never became great, but I became serviceable. And it was because of him.
Well, and that's at the end of that scene when they leave your house. He says, Billy Beane or Brad Pitt says, hey, don't mention anything about the first base. Like, so I guess that's somewhat close to reality right there. You know, 2002, you hit 280 at a 374 on base, the 807 OPS. Of course, now we know about these some of these different more modern stats, the 116 OPS plus, which was really good. You hit 15 home runs, the 61 RBI. You're on a playoff team. But talk a little bit about the 21-game winning streak. And you mentioned like how they changed things for Hollywood to tell the story about how you got signed. I once got to meet Herman Boone, who was the coach of the team in Remember the Titans that Denzel Washington played part. He came when I was at Ohio State. He came and did a showing of the movie, and then he and the assistant coach spoke. And I remember I got to ask him a question afterward. I said, what was the score of that final game? Because in the game, they had to run this play to win the game, and it was all, you know, Hollywood, you know. And he said it was 49-0. So that game was really a blowout, right? So they just torched everybody. There was no competitive game.
Yeah.
But for you, the last three wins of that 20-game winning streak were walk-off wins.
Yeah.
And then I'll set that up for you to tell me about the 20th game and the end of that game.
Yeah, no, I mean, we won in just dramatic fashion. Mm-hmm. It was at the time, it was a young team and incredibly talented. And I think that a lot of people, I got to make sure people, everybody says Moneyball, and you never hear about, we had three great pitchers, Barry Zito, Mark Mulder, Tim Hudson. And, you know, they were just young studs coming up. And they were, you know, they carried us. They kept us in every game. I mean, that's, and gave us the opportunity to be dramatic like we were. And then you have Miguel Tejada, I think was the MVP, and Chavez and Mark Ellis. I mean, we had some really, really quality players, just young. They were I was the old guy, you know, at 30, whatever I was, 33 or whatever. But these guys were just, they were fearless, and they were going to win every day. The confidence was through the roof. And for an older guy, it was really refreshing to be a part of. But we would get in situations down by two, even. They just knew somebody was going to come up. Big and honestly, like you said, those last three games, that two of them I think were Miguel Tejada came through. You know, and he was just absolutely on fire. What a talent! And then the final game, we got Tim Hudson on the hill. We're playing the Royals, who weren't, you know, like the best team in the league, but they weren't terrible. But we were like, we had this our guy on the hill. We jump out to this humongous lead. I don't know, 10-0 something.
It was
like
11,
that.
And that was in the movie too. But that's true. That really happened.
Really happened. And I'm not even playing that game because whoever was throwing for the Royals, apparently I had crap numbers against. So we jump out to the lead. I'm just going to celebrate this thing on the bench, drinking coffee, shooting the breeze with all the boys. And it just, this is like the dam. You can see it before you start crumbling and water starts coming out. Next thing you know, I'm up in the cage with Greg Myers, and one of us is going to pinch hit. I mean, this is going to go to extras. If we don't score, you know, it ends up being tied, and they call up to our stupid little cage and they said, Hattie, you're going to go hit for Burns. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, it's just, this is a no win situation. Jason Grimsley's pitching, and this guy threw 98 mile an hour freaking bowling balls, sinkers. I mean, you couldn't do anything but hit it in the ground, right?
Sure.
So I go up there. Funny side note, I'll give it to you. The I had a Louisville Slugger contract, which a lot of old guys had for 25 years. That was your bat that you could use, and I'd used it my entire life. At that point in baseball, these new garage companies started coming out with bats, and there was this one, I don't even remember the name of them, came by and gave me a little bat. It looked like furniture. It was so hard. It was, I used it in BP just not to beat up my other bats, and the ball jumped off it, and I said, you know what? I'm going to use that bat. This at bat, I'm going to use that bat because this is a no-win situation. And sure enough, somehow I get a ball up in the zone a little bit and I hit it clean. I get it, hit it out of there. Chaos ensues, right? We win the 20th game. And I go up to the clubhouse. We're celebrating. Music's going, hugs around. And this old guy comes up to me and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he goes, I'm so-and-so with the Cooperstown, the Hall of Fame. And we would like that bat. And I went, oh, no. And I reached into my locker and I handed that man a Louisville Slugger. I never told anybody that story until Michael Lewis was writing the book. And I didn't, yeah. I mean, we didn't get a whole lot of fans. I didn't think this book was really going to be anything.
Sure.
Sure enough, it became something and Cooperstown sent that bat back to me.
Oh, no. So they said, oh, you didn't give us the game used one. Yeah. Oh, man. I was going to say, if you're telling me for the first time, the statute of limitations is definitely up. But yeah. You told Michael Lewis.
Only at bat, anyway. I should have used it more.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if it was Maple, because that was maybe a little early, but that was around the time Barry Bonds started using Maple. And
it was Maple, but yeah. this was like Bionic Maple.
Okay. All right. I know Joey Votto still had Louisville Slugger until a few years ago when they ran out of ash. So yeah. Because of the ash borer. All right, so you played there, and I'm having you on to talk about on a Reds show, so let's fast forward a little bit. By the way, someone tweeted the other day, Moneyball, but the 2024 Reds, ... And I said, so a Cy Young Award winner and an MVP shortstop? Let's go. I'll sign up for that right now.
There you go. Yeah,
because they never. I don't even know if Miguel Tejada's name is mentioned in the movie. I know he's in the book, but and then, of course, you're right. They didn't really make – they glossed over the three-headed pitching monster you had that was just spectacular. All right, so on February 14th, you signed with the Reds 2006. That's right around, time to report for spring training. Overall, that was probably your best overall year of the two full years. You hit .289, .389 on base, .436 slugging, OPS plus of 109. You didn't strike out. You walked 74 times. You only struck out 41. That doesn't happen anymore, and it really wasn't happening then either. I guess talk about the signing. You mentioned Wayne Krysky already. Did it feel awfully late for you? Were you worried you weren't going to sign anywhere?
I didn't. At that time, you get to a point. I think I signed probably when I was 36, 37. I'm now a first baseman. I don't hit for a ton of power. You really got to buy into the on base right. thing I was bringing. But it becomes philosophical. Do you want the big power guy, or it depends on how you're putting together a roster. And, the one thing is I was a little cheaper than everybody else probably. Sure. So, that helped, but, and that team at the time had Griffey and Kearns and, Dunn, and there's some big home run guys. So it made sense. I think in my mind that Wayne would look for an on base guy. And I think I probably fit that bill.
Yeah.
I do have a bone to pick with the clubhouse manager, Rob Stowe.
Yes, yes.
When I showed up, not knowing anybody, not knowing anything, and he goes, "Hey, what number do you want?" And I go, "Well, this is the Cincinnati Reds, right? There's a whole bunch of numbers that are retired here, right? This is a lot of good players came through this place." And I go, "Listen, I don't know. I was number 10 in Oakland," and he goes, "I can't. That's Sparky, right?"
That's right.
And I go, "What's next?" And he goes, "Well, we got this number and that's taken and this one's taken." And I'm like, just give me a number. And he goes, "How about 21? And I said, 21. I don't. Okay. Let's be 21. First day I take the field, in Cincinnati, and I hear a chorus of, "You're never going to be Sean Casey."
And I thought, yep.
God, he gave me the mayor of Cincinnati's number.
Yep.
I stormed in there after the game. I go, "You son of a."
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I had to really, really, really put up some numbers, But I never really stopped hearing about taking Sean Casey's number. So, Sean, I apologize. Yeah.
Well, and as a fan of the Reds during that time, I was just out of college, you know, mid-20s. You know, Sean Casey was obviously a fan favorite. Yeah. And we couldn't understand why he got traded in the first place. All this stuff, was it money? What is it? They did that to Brandon Phillips when he left. He had worn number 4, and the Reds signed Scooter Gennett. And yeah. Scooter Gennett, they gave him number 4. And my goodness, you the uproar, much like you're talking about. Like,
yeah, because yeah.
Phillips had been there.
I remember firsthand.
Yeah. So, okay. So that was an intriguing year. You mentioned a little bit because of the change with the GM. They brought in Bronson Arroyo in the trade for William Opeña. David Ross was signed. And then after the season started was when they traded for Brandon Phillips. And then yourself, you were there new too as well. I guess talk a little bit about that if you would, and you know, just kind of the clubhouse vibe, because as you said, you didn't really know anybody there. You hadn't played in the National League.
Yeah, no, I did. So I was a lot, you know, this is the way the game played out was new. A lot of the, you know, at the time we weren't playing a lot of the National League teams. So you're learning new people as far as just opposing pitchers and stuff. But I'm also, you know, it's a bunch of new guys on the team. It was a really good clubhouse. It was really, it was very loose. You know, Bronson Arroyo was a great addition. Brandon brought a lot of ton of energy and what a talent he was. The pieces were there. We were putting up 8 or 9 runs a game, it seemed. And, you know, we just end up losing by a run or two. So it became a pitching thing, which makes it for a long year because the games could be pretty long. But it was a team that was really close and just a few clicks away. I think, you know, Josh Hamilton was on that team.
I think that was the next year, 07.
Was that the next year? Okay.
Yeah.
Then we ended up trading him for
Volquez.
Cueto. Was it Cueto? So
Edinson Volquez was the trade. Yeah, when you got him in the offseason between 7 and 8.
But I knew those two guys, man. I mean, these guys were going to they were going to be exciting. They were two confident, big stuff type of guys. Reminded me of Pedro. Both of them did. Young Pedro. Okay. And that was exciting. It was just kind of like the older hitter part. The offense was kind of going the other direction. And so it was kind of a flux time, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you went 80 and 82 that year. But as you mentioned, I mean, you scored 749 runs, but you gave up 801.
Yeah.
So that tells a story. But the thing that always bugged me was the Cardinals only won 83 games that year and won the World Series.
Yeah.
So you were right there with them, even in the beginning of September. But that was a tough year. Now here's a question, and feel free to take it any way you want. It's in the past, but that's the year that Krivsky traded Kearns, Felipe Lopez, and Ryan Wagner to the Nationals. You get back some more veteran type guys. Royce Clayton was in that deal. Gary Majeski ended up being hurt. Bill Bright turned out to be a pretty good arm. And we didn't understand, I don't think, just how banged up Kearns was from a shoulder surgery and injury he had two or three years earlier. But what was that trade like? Do you recall what it was like in the clubhouse when it was made and kind of the shift that was made then?
Well, I know Austin was very popular in the dugout. And, you know, anytime that there's turnover that way, and you know, Royce was a classy guy, total pro. You know, so the guys we were getting weren't bad guys.
Yeah.
They weren't hurting the clubhouse. It's just like part of that nucleus got moved. And, you know, when things are tough, people point fingers at it. I wouldn't say that it sunk the clubhouse, but maybe a little bit of a cloud kind of formed, but I don't know. We still had a nucleus of players to do well, but you know, clubhouses are weird, man. Chemistry is a finicky, weird thing. And I, you know, right now I'm a part of the A's organization. I'm a special assistant there. So you're always kind of just seeing, bringing in new guys, and you're experiencing that, how that clubhouse still works. And it's organic, man. Every time we get new guys in there, it changes a little bit here and there. You got to have the right veteran leadership, I think, to kind of write it.
Right. And
I think for the most part, it stayed solid. You know, who's to say? I don't know. I mean, Austin was a great guy, and you got to make moves sometimes in the game, and not always do they pan out.
Well, and you think of it too, in a small market team with the A's, but also the Reds, for the most part, it's been the way that, you know, the finances work. But when they market a young group of guys, Dunn, Kearns, even Felipe Lopez at the time, and Lopez, I think, had an all-star year. He had a good year a year or two earlier. But, you know, when that happens, then the fans get bought into that. And so I never know what's the difference between the fan reaction and the clubhouse reaction. It can be totally different, or maybe it's the same. I've got a question for you. Do you remember what the banana phone was?
The banana phone. Gosh, I should know this. Should I know this?
Well, so whenever the Reds had a rain delay, Marty and Joe, Marty Brenneman and Joe Nuxall would go to take calls because they had to fill the airtime. And Marty would take calls, and it would be some, these random guys. And you always wondered, is that guy, you know, three Jack Daniels in or something? Well, one night in 2006, a guy named Adam from Milwaukee called. And he asked Marty, "Marty, is Scott Hattieburg good?" Adam Dunn called Marty Brenneman and asked the question.
Listen, Adam was such a prankster. He was so enjoyable to be around. He was so funny. I think he called him more than once. And
did he
gave Marty a ton of he was always teasing Marty. Marty would come in the dugout or clubhouse, and he was always razzing him. So, yeah, I totally remember that. Gosh, he had us die laughing. Dunn was a fun teammate, man.
And just certainly you can find that if you Google it. You can find, I think, the recording of that. It was really fun. So, and in 2007, you had another good year. 310, you had on base at 394, 120 OPS plus. Again, 49 walks, 35 strikeouts. Adam Dunn was not striking out only 35 times. We know that. You know, those may have been two of your three or four best years in the big leagues offensively. And I know the ballpark maybe helped a little, but fill me in a little bit on that. Like, what are your thoughts, especially as you mentioned how much older you were getting. You had some two really good offensive years there.
Well, you know, I feel like I felt like some of my A's years. I had one year in Oakland that it was a little banged up, kind of affected me. But I feel like, you know, you do something long enough, you just get better at it. You know what I mean? So I felt like I was becoming better as a hitter. The things that I was trying to do, I was just doing more consistently. I knew exactly who I was. And you know, you take that with you going to a new environment, and a lot of times you see it in the league. A young kid comes up facing pitchers that don't know him, and they have a lot of success early. So that's kind of me a little bit, too, going to the National League. Nobody really knew who I was, and maybe I was able to adjust quicker than they were. But I did feel like I just, you know, physically I felt still strong, and I just feel like, you know, the more you do something, the better you get at it. And I just felt like I was developing as a hitter, and I think that was a lot of it. But plus, you got to say, I was surrounded by some really good hitters, too.
Yeah.
So, and I hit a lot at the top of the order there, which was weird for me. I led off a lot. I hit second a lot. And then, you know, you got Griffey and Dunn. And they were, you know, more apt to give me pitches to hit, I'd say.
Probably so. I guess because at that point, with you bringing up where you hit in the order, what was it like playing for Dusty Baker? Because that's who you played for. Well, you were with Naren.
Yeah.
Were you with Baker? Was Baker in 07 or did he not come until 08? Let's see.
He was 08. He was my last year there.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess Jerry Naren and then even Pete McCannon, which a lot of Reds fans really liked him, you know, going down through there. But you did start with Dusty. And I guess that my mistake there brings me to 2008. You started the year with the club. You were the starting first baseman on opening day. You famously gave way to Joey Votto, who was going on to have this amazing career. What was your thought going into 08? And if you don't mind my asking, I guess, what did you see in Votto? I mean, it's got to be a tough situation when you're still there and all that. I get that.
Oh, well, you see, there was an option year for me too. So I signed for 2 years and an option, and I'd seen Joey this whole time, and we became actually good friends. In fact, just texted him the other day. So we keep in touch still. And I knew right away, this is a special, special talent, just trying to figure things out. And the 07 year, we were kind of out of it at the end, and he got some at bats, and you could see from at bat to at bat, this guy was figuring it out, unlocking, and just the power and the eye, this guy was advanced, way advanced. And I knew it. And I talked to him a lot. So I knew it was going on between his ears. And, I knew this was a special talent. And I remember going into that offseason, and Krivsky was like, "Man, I think he's going to be good." And I go, "Dude, don't pick up my option. Please let me go shop. You know, I just hit 310. I go, let me go somewhere else and do, you know, and shop that." And he's like, "I just don't know if he's going to." I'm like, "Trust me, this Joey Votto dude is going to be the thing." And he came in, you know, and I started more out of respect just because I was the old guy. But I think the whole time in the cards was Votto was going to be the guy. And if he faltered, maybe I was there to, you know, be a safety net. But ultimately, it kind of ended my run, which was, you know, 39. That's probably when you should be out the door. But it was really, really fun to see Joey just realize what he was capable of. This guy, and I've been just a fan of his since, you know, and he's just developed into, you know, Hall of Fame type of player. So, yeah, pretty cool to get your job taken by caliber of that guy. You know?
Well, and I'll tell you this. I know he's talked a lot about in the media this past year about the way the clubhouses were back then with the veterans. And he came in when Griffey was in that clubhouse. That's a big personality, certainly. And, but he's also talked about being there maybe for the younger guys, even if it means that guy's going to take my job eventually or whatever. And I remember at the time, I have a good memory for, you know, these things. And I remember him speaking well of you as well back then. So certainly, I guess you, as you mentioned, you were 39 that was your 38 season, but yeah, I guess you saw it and you still had no reason to be a jerk to somebody, right? I guess.
Oh, no, he was one of my favorite players on the team. I mean, we were great. A lot of, you know, in fact, Jeff Conine, both first basemen. I mean, he may be my best friend in the game right now. I mean, he's just, I think you get into a team environment and you end up being brothers. I think the ones that really work that way. I mean, that's the only way to really approach it. Ultimately, yeah, we're competing, but we're competing, you know, basically pitcher versus hitter. You're not really competing against any, you know, your teammates so much. You know, maybe they motivate your effort and your output or whatever. But I always looked at teammates, you know, as brothers more than anything. So, and there's certain ones are better than others, obviously. And you get along with other guys better than others. But Joey and I always got along. I mean, just a solid quality dude.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to ask you just maybe about some specific players, if you don't mind, in our last few minutes together. And we've already talked a little bit about some of these guys, but Adam Dunn, certainly you mentioned, you know, you carry a friendship with him even to this day. So that's pretty cool. What was he like, you know, his talent? Because I remember the whole thing, will he play at Texas? Will he play quarterback? Yeah. Will he play baseball? And then he just goes and hits 40-plus home runs every year and 100 RBI, 100 walks.
It was almost weird. I'd go, why you hit it the number every year? I mean, I looked at his card not too recent. It's 100, 140, like multiple years in a row, exactly those numbers. He was a freak. He always said that he was terrible. He had like no confidence. And I don't know if it was an act or not. He just said, Scott, I'm so bad. I'm just so, yeah. How would it, he was sitting in his locker. We're 15 minutes before the game. And he's going, I'm going to go 0 for again today. I'm going to go over. How's the feel to get two hits? You know you're going to get two hits today, don't you? I know I'm going to get zero hits. I go, dude, you're going to hit a ball 490 feet.
That's right, in the river.
In the river. I couldn't hit two balls that far. And he would just sit there and just no confidence. And he, more of it was comedy. He had that kind of Will Ferrell characteristic about him. But this guy had raw power like it's hard to describe. Mm-hmm. He could hit him and Willie Mopena. I remember when I first showed up in spring training, they had a thing where you spent the entire spring training with your hitting group. And my hitting group, mind you, Mr. Walk and slap it over shortstop guy, was Willie Mopena and Adam Dunn. And these dudes, I couldn't even watch him hit. You know, they would point things out, not just home runs, but like signs that are beyond the parking lot or, you know, let's hit that, you know, the fruit sign above the center field sign about 40 feet. And sure enough, man, these guys could do it. They were freaks, strong ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Adam Dunn, I always gave him crap about, I go, you were that good at football? Because you look like you throw grenades when you throw a baseball. I go, you must have run a lot. Anyway, he's a great guy.
No doubt. And, of course, he was drafted in the second round because of the football thing. They drafted Kearns in the first round and Dunn in the second round, and that really worked out for the Reds. And then you mentioned growing up where you did with Ken Griffey Jr. being, you know, the hero of the Northwest, certainly in baseball circles. What was it like to come to a team that he actually played on?
It was beyond a thrill. One of my favorite, you know, parts of my career was getting to know him. And, you know, we spent a lot of time together, Adam and him and I. We did a lot of – he loved Benihana. We went to about every Benihana in every city and across the country. But just, I've never been around a guy that, I guess, Jordan-ish, you know, would be the only, we couldn't go to movie theaters, restaurants without like calling ahead and really, this guy is a celebrity like that. It's like I'd never seen before. I mean, everybody, this guy, but he loved the locker room. He loved his teammates. He loved the whole court. He loved to talk. And he loved to work too. And when it was time to go, this guy could swing. I could take 15 swings and be exhausted. This guy would take 80 swings and fresh as the first one he took. So, just a special talent, a special guy, and huge thrill.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when he came to Cincinnati, being from there, and I mean, I remember being in high school drawing up outfields that would include three guys from Cincinnati, including him, and David Justice was from right across the river there and in Covington. So it was like, oh, well, if he could play here and he could play here. And I just remember when he finally came, it was like, oh, my goodness, we got him. And certainly the injuries and things like that were not the best thing for him or us as fans. David Ross came to the team there, as I mentioned, right either before opening day or just after in 06. Certainly he's gone on to be a manager and he's been on TV. What was he like when he joined the team and kind of as a guy to be around?
Great guy. Another great guy. I mean, he was an asset locker room guy. Really, really good catcher. This is exactly who you want behind the plate. You know, he was energetic. He was into it. He's a very good student of the game. You could tell there was that catching knowledge, with a charisma, handled the staff extremely well. Sneaky pop guy, he was always a danger to go deep, really good guy. Ended up becoming a manager. Didn't surprise me at all. I mean, this guy had all the ingredients to be that type of guy. He was a little more reserved, I'd say now. But now that personality, you'd see it now and then come out. But as far as like being the TV guy and all, it's good to see him blossom like that. He's a quality guy.
What about Edwin Encarnacion? Certainly completely blossomed later with Toronto and had a great, great career. A certain announcer on TV at the time, he would ride him a little bit, and I thought that kind of influenced fans' opinions of him. But we're talking a guy that was only like 23 probably in 06 when you played with him. But when you look at now his numbers and understand, as I do a little more, what really matters, on-base percentage and slugging for him were amazing. Eventually, he hit the home runs. He had 26 one year at the Reds. What was it like to see his talent? And could you tell he would eventually be what he became?
Yeah. You know, with Edwin, he was a really quiet guy, very reserved, nice guy, hard worker, uber talented. I mean, you could see the talent. Honestly, the only ingredient that I saw for him was just believing in himself. He had some doubt. I remember being, as a first baseman, he had some issues throwing, he cut the ball a lot, and he had some unforced throwing errors. I know why that sometimes affected his mental part. Maybe I'm me assuming this, but I just thought, man, when this guy just decides to be, believe in himself and be confident, the power and the strength is there. The natural hitability is there. He's going to be a freak, and he sure enough became a freak. Man, the ball jumped off this kid's bat. He took a wallop at him, man. I love guys that swing from their heels. This guy, to watch him end up becoming what he became up, he ended up believing himself. That guy's
sure, absolutely. Player. What about Bronson Arroyo? Another character joined the team there right at the beginning of 06.
Yeah, Bronson was like the hippie guitar guy that was just kind of everybody loved. He was happy go lucky, rubber elastic arm.
Sure.
You could count on him. He was not afraid to do things, try things. He had the big cojones. This guy was who you want on the hill in a big game. Maintained a great even keel at all times. He was just, he was a clubhouse favorite. Everybody liked Bronson. He was funny. He was a easygoing dude.
Yeah. Now you did kind of probably know Aaron Harang before, because he had been in Oakland and been traded. He and Bronson made a good 1-2 punch there for a couple years. That was, the pitching issues were more depth, I think, than what was at the top.
Yeah, Harang was sneaky consistent and sneaky good. I don't think he got the credit. He didn't light up the gun, but he's one of those guys that the ball got on hitters, like maybe two clicks above. And okay. we're starting to, with analytics, figuring out why that is. There is some guys that fall into that category. We didn't really know it back then. You just get guys who come to first base and go, my God, it says 93, but dude, it feels like it's 96. Mm-hmm. And he was just, you know, like you said, consistent, took the ball every fifth day. He was one of those quiet assassins. And he just kept doing it. He reminded me a little bit of Aaron Seeley, just plugged and chugged. And, you know, he didn't really, have one season maybe that blew you away, but look at the body of work and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, 15, 16 wins multiple years and a lot of other of the ancillary stats that really add up to make to matter. Last couple, Josh Hamilton, you mentioned him already. He came over in the Rule 5 draft in 07. Everybody kind of knew his story, certainly with the substance abuse issues and things like that. He only played about 90 games that year, and then they traded him. But what was it like kind of to see that? And then, boy, the loaded outfield. You had Griffey, Dunn, Josh Hamilton, and Jay Bruce is kind of pushing up through, hoping to join. It was like, whoa, what are we going to do with all these outfielders?
Yeah, Jay Bruce, that's a good one too. That was a talented kid.
Yeah.
Josh was, you know, we all knew the story and we knew whatever. And I remember seeing him in spring training and the body, the moves, this is the package. Mm-hmm. Where is he as far as the baseball form? And there was rust in spring training, but the talent, you'd see it just, you could, when he threw, when he moved, when he, you know, squared a ball up, you just go, oh my gosh, you know, this is the five tool guy people like to throw around, but this is the real deal five tool guy. You know, and he was just coming back, and I know he had certain issues with, you know, how he just did everyday life. He was getting everyday life ironed out, let alone trying to get to the major league level as far as baseball. So watching him do that was really fun. And you could, you know, I mean, the talent was, that's special, real special.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was just something else. And certainly he did go on to win the MVP. And if you think about that, the year he won the MVP for the Rangers, Votto won it with the Reds. So, you know, one of those what might have been type things. You mentioned working for the A's. I'll get you out on here on this. What type of things do you do with the A's? And obviously you're not in charge of moving day, I would assume.
No, I'm a special assistant. I do a ton with the scouting side. I mean, the A's, we don't spend a whole bunch of money. So we got to draft the Hamiltons and the Mike Trouts of the world. We can't really go sign them. So I do a lot with that. Spring training, I'm another coach. Mm-hmm. I do a lot on the player development side once the draft's over. So I'm just trying to stay involved. I like being part of the team still, and you know, keeps me going, keeps me young. Like being with hitters, I like teaching hitting. So yeah, I've been doing that for about 12 years now. So enjoying it.
That is really cool, and certainly, I'm sure it's probably a hard situation. You don't have to comment it since you work for the team, but seeing what's going on with the stadium and the fans and everything from afar is kind of a tough look. You know, it's really hard to see it. It's what?
It's worse when you're up close to it.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. There's real sympathy there for people like yourself who work for them, but also for the fans and what's going on. So I don't think there's a perfect scenario yet. Oh, I wanted to show you. I have this Adam Dunn. I don't know if it's because he used REO Speedwagon, but they put this 80s, you know, Miami Vice looking bobble out. Really funny.
It looks like David Letterman, kind of.
It does. I've always thought that too. Absolutely. Well, hey Scott, I've held you up way too long. I really appreciate you. You know, I emailed through the PR team and said I've only done one episode, but would he talk to me? So, I love that you were willing to do it, and I just enjoy going down memory lane with you.
You bet, Seth. I enjoyed it, man.
All right, you have a great day, and thanks for tuning in to Red Leg Roundtable. All right, I'm going to.
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.